It's rolling. Red lights means it's on. Check, 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 check. I can
Hello,
hear me.
You can hear me?
Yep, hear both of us. So welcome, Catherine Lutz.
Lutz, you Lutz. Asked me.
I know. We're just hanging out at Astrolab and we're talking a little bit about cinematography.
Yeah.
Maybe we can find out how Catherine got into this field and a bit about the work that she does.
Yeah, I went to film school at UBC and then I stayed in Vancouver for way too long. Once I graduated, I was shooting. I was like a DP, but I was really just doing my friends' projects, student projects, free stuff, whatever I could. And at the same time, I was working in lighting. There was one particular DP who kind of brought me out on everything, and I would work mostly in lighting, occasionally like camera assisting, but not really. I was a terrible camera assistant. So he was teaching me a lot about lighting and DPing, and then started to kind of give me jobs that he was too busy to do, usually shorts and things like that. And that kind of helped continue the DP part of it. But I was just doing it at the same time. I came to Toronto and just sort of left the lighting side of it in Vancouver and just decided, like, I'm just a cinematographer now. No more lighting gigs.
And when you were working with that other DP, is he still around?
Yeah, his name's James Liston. He's in Vancouver. I think he's shooting right now a series Supergirl or something. Like, he's shooting one of those kind of action things. Yeah.
When you were starting it, was it working on the bigger production work or like one man band docy kind of style stuff? Or
it was still pretty small, like indie stuff. And then I joined the union there as a lighting technician, a spark or whatever. And I don't think I really ever actually did any days as a union lamp op. I just decided at the same time that I would leave and come to Toronto, and it wasn't really a way I wanted to go. I had started doing some days on made-for-TV movies and some of those productions out in Vancouver, and I just immediately was like, I don't want to be seeing this stuff. Like, I don't want to be creating it, so it's not really where I want to learn. And I felt like if I'm there watching all these techniques, it's like not the input that I wanted. And I like always tell this story and people latch onto it all the time, but it's the same crew I was working with on these made-for-TV movies. We went out on a show, and I didn't know what it was. And it was, like, in a house that was quite small. And so they were like, there's only room for one person to be in the house. And, of course, I'm, like, super keener, like, I want to be in the house. I want to be in the house. And I'm watching this thing being shot, and I'm like, this is not a made-for-TV movie. This is amazing. Like, the DP was kind of rolling on stuff that was, like, off book, and they were like getting me to do really interesting, very naturalistic lighting stuff, and I was just like, this is amazing. And at the end of the day, I kind of like actually realized that it was Catherine Bigelow was directing, and it was Hurt Locker. It was like the pickups they did in Vancouver of when he's home. So yeah, that was like a nice, like, oh yeah, those are the kind of movies I want to make, not the made-for-TV movies.
But if we were to take it a step further back from that,
yeah,
and think about, as a kid, was movie and storytelling, were you reading comics? Were you?
I, like, in high school, was sort of a theater nerd. I did a lot of drama. And I definitely remember the, like, light switch of the first time we had to all do our own productions. And, like, basically I was in charge of lighting it. I remember that moment of, like, oh, lighting. Like, this is, you can tell these stories, but I'm limited by this box of a stage. And so it was like, what can you do when you take it outside into the real world? I remember that kind of being a moment of like excitement. But I was also taking a lot of photos as a high school student too.
So were you doing like darkroom developing, printing your own stuff as well?
A little bit. I never got like that deep into it, but I did a little bit. Yeah. And never color, just black and white.
And when you were shooting photos, were you doing a lot of lighting or more natural capturing moments?
Yeah,
or
natural. Yeah.
Did you have any major influences? Some people are film nerds and they know every single DP and every single director. Is that kind of your thing? Did you follow certain people or is it kind of?
Not really. I mean, I think there are people who are pretty amazing now. I'm going to just like blank and not remember anybody. But I was definitely a teenager who like didn't love the fact that I was growing up in the suburbs. And so I was drawn to anything that seemed like, I'm using the air quotes of like edgy to me. And now looking back, I'd be like, oh my God, I don't love the look of Natural Born Killers. But at the time I was like, oh my God, this is what a movie can be. This is so crazy.
Yeah.
And Harmony Korine, I really loved. And like all these sort of movies that just seemed so crazy to me were really appealing. And I still do love Harmony Korine. I still think Gummo is a really awesome movie.
Were your parents a big influence at all on storytelling and movies, or is that you did your own thing?
Yeah, not really. I mean, it's funny looking back now, my mom did take a lot of photos when she was younger and when we were kids, but my parents weren't super like creative storytelling kind of folks. My mom was a nurse and my stepdad was a teacher.
And so you kind of gravitated towards the lighting side. So what was your first kind of like step into the lighting world? Who did you meet? How did you get onto a set to do lighting?
I think in Vancouver, it was sort of through the same thing, like that DP that I had been working with, just because I was super keen. I was very eager and keen, and I was like constantly trying to learn and also just collaborate with him. He was very open to that. So I started doing some gaffing for him. And I mean, probably I was gaffing, but he was still helping me with a lot of that. There's a lot of technical knowledge of a gaffer that I don't have now, and I probably didn't have then, but it was smaller projects and I was able to kind of do it with his help. I think it was all kind of through the same few people in Vancouver. It's like those people just kind of give you your break and then it all starts to spiral, you know? But I was working a lot too, like shooting short films with people I went to film school with.
Do you find you still have those connections with those people? I mean, it's Vancouver.
Yeah, actually. Yeah, there's a few people who are all still kind of friends and collaborators.
Technology's changed quite significantly with LEDs and all that stuff that's happening now. Are you somebody who goes and does lighting tests and like tests the color of a certain light and like gets really technical about using specific lights?
Not really. I'm not a super technical filmmaker, I don't think. I don't get too caught up in it, and I feel like my brain doesn't have the capacity for like technical specs memorizing. So I don't get crazy caught up. I go a little bit more by instinct, or I find the tools that I just like and then I end up sticking with them a lot. But I know that with the changing technology, you have to educate yourself to a certain extent. But there is like amazing LED tools out there that I've been getting into. So a lot of that also comes from having technicians that you like working with who can bring some of that knowledge too, where I can kind of describe to them what I'm looking for and they can introduce me to some of those new tools as well.
Do you have any specific people that you work with that have been super helpful? Like a gaffer that you...
In Toronto, I think there are a lot of people who are good. Younger people who now aren't the young people and I can't book anymore because they're on commercials every day. Like Ryan Hernandez and TJ Richardson totally. And those guys are just like, oh, okay, bye. But they are great and just have like a nice attitude of things on set as well and have a care for it. It's a hard thing probably like as a technician. Do you care what the project is that you're working on or are you really just there as a job? And so I try to find people who care about the project.
Yeah, that's true because the guys that you did just mention, they always have some kind of input that relates to the story. So if you tell them you want to have a light here, it's supposed to feel like this, and they'll always come back and say, maybe we can put a slash here because it's supposed to be morning, right? So I think the light would bounce and it would come into this way and it's not going to affect the character, but you know, help the background. But they always have some just extra bit of input that's not strictly technical.
Yeah.
And it's not strictly just executing what you want to execute.
Yeah.
They have something else they bring to the table. And I find in Toronto, there's a lot of gaffers that I've worked with as well that have that kind of care. I guess maybe they've come from more of the filmmaking side, not just strictly a technician side.
Yeah, I also like the value of a key grip is insane to me. And I think that's something I've only really realized in the last like 5 years, just how much they can bring to it. And also as like a dolly grip, they have an understanding of movement sometimes that they can help me with, you know, and the shaping of the light is so much more important than setting a light sometimes.
Yeah, it's nice when you have somebody who's got your back.
Yeah.
What about camera technology? Do you usually advise right off the top what camera packages you'd like to work with?
Yeah, I do. I'm not like overly caught up in using like the newest, shiniest toy all the time. I try to make it informed on what the story is. Also with the constraints of the production are. I've made a choice before of having like an Amira on a super small doc shoot and being like, I wish I had a C300.
Yeah.
Like the images look great, but it's just like too bulky for what we're doing.
Totally.
I mean, I generally tend to go the like Alexa route these days, but I'm open to different things.
And what about lenses? It sounds like you work more from aesthetic and look.
Yeah.
So do you spend time with resolution charts and testing lenses on that level or is it?
Not a ton. Like I don't care so much for resolution. It's funny the feature I just did, I was like trying to make it noisier and beat up the image a little bit more because we really did want to shoot on 16 but couldn't afford to. So it's like, you're never going to match that look. But the director was just like, I don't want this to look like everything on Netflix. I don't want it to look clean. That was kind of fun, trying to like beat it up, trying to push the ISO high.
Yeah, so what kind of things did you push the ISO? What else did you do get there?
Everything was like shot at a higher ISO. We used super speeds, which I use often, but are a bit older, a little softer. I didn't mind like having them wide open. I don't mind having some of the image fall apart a little bit in that way. I use a lot of softening filters and then developed some LUTs that also were pushing things a little bit further to not be the look of 709.
So filtration wise, do you have certain ones that you gravitate towards for certain reasons?
I just like weirdly a few years ago found something that I liked and then have like never changed. But I think it's probably time for me to explore some other options. I do test other filters and then I usually just end up being like, I'll take the glimmer glass.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know what that is. It's sort of just instinctual aesthetic. I'm not so technical to like explain why usually.
No, that's
I'm
great.
I'm just like, I like that.
Yeah. So, you know, you did mention something about LUTs there too.
Yeah.
Do you find that you said you had like 6 different ones on this recent shoot that you were on.
Yeah.
And you don't bake those in, do you?
We didn't bake them in, but then I did, like I got the script supervisor and the editor to be making those notes so that the editor was processing it with those individual LUTs on it. Just so in the editing process, they can have that. Because again, like as we were talking about at that roundtable discussion, people get so attached to what they're used to seeing. And if they're editing the whole film in Rec. 709, they just don't want to make changes when you get to color. Often. I mean, there are certain directors who totally understand and are looking at it knowing that they can play and change things, but some don't. And so they don't want to see change. Even if you're like, but it wasn't intended to look like this. Yeah. And on the micro budget side of things, it's so hard because you don't have money to have a DIT there doing everything, which is like the biggest fight that I would normally want on every project is to have somebody who's on set with you. We couldn't afford that. So that was sort of my solution. It was to have these LUTs that were already there.
So to create those LUTs, did you work with a colorist or did you do them on your own?
I worked a bit with a colorist and they're still pretty loose. Like there was not a ton of time to do as much testing with them as I would have liked to. So I did sort of after the first couple of days of shooting the feature, I did send him some images that I would take stills of on set and just be like, is there a way that you can kind of shift this LUT to be a little bit more warm or whatever, a little bit more contrast. And so he would sort of email them back to me and we would upload them the next day.
Yeah, so you weren't doing any work in camera. You actually had the colorist doing it all.
Yeah, remotely. Being like, can you please?
Is there someone that you're working with recently?
That was Andrew Salke, who's usually an on-set DIT. I just had worked with him on a couple of things. And actually, Bobby had recommended him to me. I just think he has a good sensibility about color. So do you use LUTs on set?
Depends on the camera system.
Yeah.
C300, you can't do anything more than Rec. 709. So that's kind of what it is.
Yeah.
I'll never bake it in. I actually had a discussion with somebody else about that before. I was helping him out on the project, so I was doing B camera. We were rolling, and then I thought it was, I went to turn the LUT off just so I could double check and make sure we're clean for highlights and everything like that. And I couldn't turn the LUT off. I kept pushing the button and it's like, nothing's happening. And I turned to him like, are you baking the LUT in? He's like, yeah. I'm like, okay, I can't do anything about it now.
Yeah.
But I was like,
why?
Yeah. I was like, why? He's like, well, I just want to make sure he puts the right one on. I'm like, well, it's like,
yeah.
We had to talk about it afterwards. I'm like, it's just a button push. Like,
yeah.
You give him the LUT and.
The only thing it makes sense for is like, news capture or something where you don't have the post process and you just have to turn it around really quick.
Or someone doesn't know what they're doing on the back end in the editing and they don't know how to just throw the LUT into the right file folder or whatever it is, which is understandable. It's not super difficult, but it just depends on whoever's doing the post, their experience. And how are you finding, because everyone's got their stories about how they're trying to find that life work balance, still making a career, still making money, still doing passion projects, now taking on the more serious kind of work, which can take you away for a month, 2 months, 6 months, who knows, depends on the project. How are you managing your time away and also being here?
Probably terribly. I don't have a life. No, I do try to make the balance, but obviously there's times where you just can't. And I'm sort of in that right now where it's like, I knew that I really wanted to do this feature. And then back to back, I was going to do the series and I'm sneaking a short film in the between the two just because it's like a longtime collaborator and a really good project. Normally I would have probably tried to take the 2 weeks I had in between and like revive myself as a person, but I'm gonna kind of push through this one. I don't know, in the last few years I've been trying really consciously to make the effort to at least take a vacation in the year. You know, usually around Christmas and New Year's we don't really work that much unless you know you're going to work. Like, it doesn't pop up last minute. Hey, can you work January 2nd? Like, barely ever happens. So I've been really trying to take a few weeks vacation. I feel like that's just so important to the brain and the eye, and creativity is like being able to step away from just looking at film and what you're filming and just live a bit.
And I think you mentioned this once before too, for your own inspiration and to develop your style. It's not so much watching films. You were saying it's more so...
Yeah, I try. I mean, we all watch films and I end up also watching like way too much TV that I'm like, why am I watching this? But yeah, like life can be the most inspiring stuff, I think. And just like having time to kind of let your brain sit with something and not have a screen in front of it is pretty important. Hard to do. Which is crazy. It's like it's hard for us to just like disconnect, but...
We've all kind of had situations on set where you make one mistake once and you never do it again.
Mm.
Like showing up on set and say you don't have a battery or you don't have a cable and you think you do, but you don't, and it happens. Or you forget to hit the red button and the red button you think's going, but it's not going. You gotta explain that to someone. Like, have you had one of those kind of like situations where you learned your lesson once and you're not going to do it again?
Oh, I'm sure I have, but I probably just erase them from my memory as quick as possible and like try not to dwell on it. But it's hard, you know, like mistakes are always still going to get made. And I see them happening, like, I don't know, we just doing this micro budget, not that anything major happened, but like small things do happen. And especially when you're in situations that are like run and grun and smaller crews and, you know, I'm like, I just can't dwell on it. You gotta let it go.
You mentioned that you haven't done a ton of music video work and that might be something you'd be interested in, but it's not really on your radar right now, or?
I don't know. I think it's partly just like the people and the connections you make like lead you into the worlds that you're doing. And yeah, for some reason, I wasn't doing very many music videos. Like, I've done a handful of them, but I just have never been in that world, but I really love it. I don't know. When I was a kid, I would run home from school and like I have VHS tapes of The Wedge and Rhapsody where I would just like sit there and tape music videos. And obviously like growing up and watching sort of like the Spike Jones, Michel Gondry, all that stuff happening was like very inspiring. So I love the medium of a music video to play, but I haven't done that many.
You started doing more narrative work. Was it with friends or short films, or was it something?
Yeah, shorts and like coming out of film school and kind of continuing to do those sort of things. I'm trying to think, because I did heavily swing into doc world. Maybe part of that was when I moved to Toronto. That was a lot more of the work that was accessible for me. Like, I found in Vancouver at the time it was tricky. There's those huge productions happening. So as a DP, you're not going to finish film school and start shooting X-Men 7 or whatever, right? And then I'd really done all the freebies and the short films, and I didn't find a lot of in between. I think that their industry has changed a little bit, and I think there is more of like an indie scene growing there. But at the time, it didn't feel like there was much. So coming here to Toronto, there's like TV, there's commercials, there was doc. And so I really did a lot more doc stuff when I came here. And I love doing that. I love being able to just do the quick, small crew, natural light.
For you to get work starting out and now, was your reel very important to you? Was it connections and relationships that were really important? What helped you to move to where you are today?
When I first started, I actually was pretty picky about the projects that I did. And I think that that was a good thing because I kind of created the kind of work that I wanted to be hired for. That was my reel. That's what I was showing people. Those were the only jobs I was taking. Probably because I was like young and I also just like had part-time jobs doing other things at the same time. Yeah, it's a weird thing because I go back and forth in my brain about giving advice to people, whether that's the way to go or whether it's like work on everything so that you are practicing the craft and honing the skills and all the stuff. I don't know. I don't know if that's true because I do think if you want to work on a specific style of thing or you have a particular aesthetic, if you're doing a bunch of stuff that's way off of that, people are never gonna take you to do what you want to do. If you're like shooting a bunch of horror movies, they're not gonna be like, do you want to do this like comedy or whatever? I don't know, you know, it's a hard thing. People only often can only see what you're showing them. They can't imagine that you can do other stuff unless you can show them you've already done it.
I've heard different things from different DPs and agencies about what they look for when they're trying to hire a DP. And for this job, do they want to see my narrative reel? Do they want to see my reel that shows all my interviews I've shot, the reel that shows all my product stuff, because I'm applying for this certain job? And then I've also heard that some people are like just putting together what they want as the best representation of who they are and the type of work they want to do.
Yeah.
So maybe there is a commercial that's a shoe commercial and you're up for it. You're not going to put together a reel that shows all your shoe stuff, because potentially they'll hire you as a technician at that point, not because of your emotional style or your creativity.
Right.
But they're like, she can execute that. We've seen her do shoes before. She's a shoe person.
Yeah.
Don't need to worry about it.
It seems like that's the commercial world for sure. Yeah. And I've definitely lost commercial jobs because they're like, where is your exact commercial that we want to shoot already shot? And you're like, I can shoot a family sitting at a dining room table. Like, I've done features of people sitting at tables. But if you don't have that commercial, then they don't hire you. But I guess you can also just decide when to show that stuff and not to show it. You know, like, there's just so much work that no one ever sees. And you kind of have to decide what you want people to see and not see.
Yeah, so how have you built your reel, your current one that you have right now?
My current reel is super dated and I haven't updated it in like 4 years. But yeah, I try to just show people the kind of work that I want to continue to work on.
You've got an agent repping you now, right?
Yeah.
How did you make the transition from freelancing to deciding or to have somebody actually represent you?
What happened? I guess I sort of met with a few people in the States and did they approach? I think I kind of approached them, or friends who were filmmakers had suggested me to them. And so then that conversation started happening. I don't know how it works with agents. I don't know the game plan. Like, are you supposed to approach them? You just wait for them to approach you? What do you do? I don't know. It's sort of a mystery world.
Have you found that the type of work that you are able to get now has changed significantly, or are you still using your own personal connections?
I think mostly it's still personal connections. It does help for commercial stuff. And even if that is still personal connections, I was friends with a lot of commercial directors and they weren't really able to bring me out before. But now with the agent, it seems to like legitimize you to a certain extent, which is kind of crazy. But it seems like in Canada, they want DPs from these agencies, and that's sort of it.
I don't know if you've noticed as well, since you were fully accepted into the CSC, having that behind your name has made a difference as well?
I'm not sure. I mean, maybe it's too new still to know, but it feels nice. It's like a nice thing to feel like you're professionally at that level. I don't know what it means for hiring or for jobs or whatever, or how people see that, but...
Have you come from any of the post side of things? Were you ever editing projects yourself?
Just like super minorly, or like very basic resolve skills. It's actually something that I constantly am like, I'd love to learn more about. Not editing, but just especially the color world. So I need to take some courses.
Because I know some people, they find that their background for understanding storytelling and cutting and pacing has come from working as an editor. How have you found that you've kind of come to understand how to cut shots? You know, when you're talking with a director or someone about, you know, I need coverage of a wide here. No, you know, you don't need this shot because we're going to get it all in this wide. Like, we don't need these inserts, or we do need these inserts.
Yeah.
Where does your sensibility come from for that?
I think that partly is from like watching a lot of movies. I also spent a lot of time earlier on in my career with editors and with the editors of projects that I was working on, kind of sitting in or trying to understand, just having conversation. I had a really good friend of mine who was an editor, so we were kind of constantly having a dialogue that I think helped me learn a lot more about it. I value an editor so much. Yeah. You put so much trust in them. You know, certain projects are very like shot to be edited a certain way, and other projects, you know that editor is going to be taking this footage and could go so many different ways with it. The editor is like is such a valuable alliance, you know?
Yeah, like even for me, I've been on a number of projects where I'm so excited about the project. I put so much into it on the day that we're shooting it. You put so much effort in, and then you see the final execution, you're like,
that's what you did with it?
Really? And you're so excited to show people your work and be like, yeah, come and watch this thing. And it's like, whoa,
yeah,
I don't know if I want to show anybody this. And I really wish, because I've just dedicated X amount of days or months, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh.
I find that the hardest with doc stuff. And, you know, fair enough, they have to probably go through like hours and hours and hours of footage. And I just expect them to understand the moments that I think are the best. And they're not. Like, everyone has a different aesthetic, so they're going to grab on to different beats maybe than you would as a cinematographer. I find on documentary especially, because often you're just like rolling on a lot more. You're hoping to catch a moment, so you roll on something that doesn't work, you know? But it's like, what are you supposed to do? Go back and delete the clip before you give it to them?
Yeah.
I've often thought about that. I'm like, should I delete these?
I've been told before when I was learning from different cinematographers that every single frame that you roll on, you have to be able to say that I could print this frame and put it on my wall and sign my name on it. Like every single frame you put up.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that as a mentality maybe of something narrative or a little more controlled. But I find with doc, sometimes it's, you have to tell the story. And so to be like super like, I can't roll right now because this doesn't look good, might not tell the story.
You miss the moment.
Yeah.
Doc, when it's moving that fast.
Yeah. Or you have a person who's like giving you something, you have to like take it and not be, you know, you can't be selfish about what it looks like sometimes.
And we've also heard people talking about a certain style of work that you get recognized for and whether that's a style that is going to complement a story or not. So you can tell sometimes when you watch a film that it's a certain DP style and whether that style is actually helping the story or not helping the story. Like, do you have those kind of discussions when you're getting into a project? Maybe you like to use a certain type of lens on somebody because you feel that you're just comfortable on a longer lens or you're comfortable on a wider lens. So is there a certain style that you have, or have you been in situations where that might not work for the story that you found out as you're going along?
Yeah, I definitely try to base the style off of what the story needs are and not be like, this is what I like to do. I think I probably innately have some sort of style that's there. It's hard to pinpoint and be like, this is what I do. I like handheld camera a lot. I do feel comfortable when I'm operating. So that's sort of something that a style that I like, but it's not hard and fast because I also really love the challenge of doing something like super formal, all sticks, like really quiet, locked off. I love that too. But yeah. I don't know what my style is. Do I have a style?
I don't know. Like, even the technology that's come around, like with the Ronins and yeah, all that, yeah. That Steadicam stuff, not Steadicam, but the gimbal work, has that been pushed onto you to kind of inform or change the way you're working?
I don't know if it makes me like a weird old, like my parents, but I really don't love using that stuff, the gimbals and the, I don't know. I think there are places for it. I think I'm just probably not often making films that have a place for it. I don't know what that is. That might just be like the kind of story and the kind of directors that I'm drawn to or who are drawn to me. But I think there are places for all those. I don't use a lot of a Ronin or Movi. But part of that too is probably just like not having a good handle on it. I've had it out and it'd be sort of almost disastrous.
Yeah.
Because you can't just pick up a tool and expect to be great at it. The theory of some of those where they were like, yeah, but now you don't need to have an operator. That now you're the operator and here, you know, it can be a single operator thing and all this stuff. It's like, maybe if I had been doing this or if I had time and I learned that skill, but just kind of picking it up is, I don't know, can be kind of a disaster.
Yeah, you're exactly right about being a skill. It's its own thing.
I think probably the best way to use those is bringing people out who are operators of them, who have like honed that skill.
And what about your personal kit of gear? Like, you're not like an owner operator.
In the last couple of years, started to get some pieces of things that I like, but I don't own like a camera. I own a light mat these days that I've been using a lot. And I just got an Easy Rig. I was so resistant to Easy Rigs for so long because I just didn't find them actually that helpful for me, but got a small one.
Yeah. I just got one too as
Did
well.
Did you?
Yeah, the Vario 5.
Yeah, yeah.
I got the gimbal support vest. I guess it's basically like the deluxe vest.
Yeah, right.
But I heard that they've won for women as well.
Yeah, it's like the Cinema Flex vest. I just used it quite a bit on the feature that I was on, but I would sort of rotate between that and like my old handheld ways, which is like a Fernie blanket tied around my waist. And it was good. It was nice to actually have those two tools as options. But it's funny because a lot of directors are misinformed about what an Easy Rig is, and people think it's like a Steadicam or some kind of stabilizing tool.
Quite
and
the
like,
opposite.
Yeah, yeah, like walking with an Easy Rig is putting a lot of movement into a camera.
Yeah. Have you tried with the Serene Arm options or anything?
No, like remember we were talking about that because you were testing it. Yeah. Did you end up going with that?
I ended up doing actually a ruddy rig for gimbal work and an easy rig for handheld work that it's going to be long takes. I potentially could have gone with the easy rig with the Serene arm but for the versatility, because the easy rig at that point, you can't get into a high mode with a gimbal, the easy rig and the Serene arm. Right. Like, you only get the camera a certain level, but neither one's going to give you any kind of solution for stabilizing as you walk forward that bounce. You just can't get rid of it.
Yeah, that's where my blanket rig works better, I think. I don't know. I mean, it looks stupid, but it works great.
Yeah. No, you find something that works and it's perfect. I mean, my kit, I often carry around a pair of rollerblades.
Yeah.
That I can just throw on and off if I need to. Just, and I'll get a dolly grip or someone just to push me. And there's been plenty of times where we've been able to get through a day much faster because they want to do a walk with somebody.
Right.
And it's like, okay, well, we don't have a steady cam. And if I walk with this shot on a 50 mil or whatever it might be, it's not going to work. So just put me on a cart, pull me, or put me on some blades and pull me, whatever it's going to be, just to get through it.
Yeah. I would say, like, style-wise too, just thinking about that as you're mentioning it, is like, I don't do handheld on long lenses really. I just stay away from it because it's an aesthetic I just never really like. And people are always like, yeah, I can do it and it's pretty steady. And then you're just looking at it and you're like, oh no, that doesn't look good.
Yeah.
Because I like a subdued handheld. Although the feature I just did is a little bit wild. It feels handheld.
For the aesthetic for that one, maybe you can speak just a little bit about that project.
Yeah, I'm super excited about it. And I think that's why doing a micro budget is like for me to explore and to take some risks and do some things that I don't get to do that often. And it was like a script and a director that I really loved. So the aesthetic is definitely rough, and the whole thing is handheld. We did really long takes that were kind of me feeling it out with the actors sometimes. I try to be conscious enough, like, again, going back to the editing thing, of not totally screwing over an editor. And you have to be aware, like, if you're doing one long take, you got to find something, some cutting points if they need them, ideally. And sometimes you make that call, like, this is one shot. This whole thing's going to work in this one thing that we did. But you never know what happens when you get to an editing room, and for story and performance and all those things, there's usually got to be another option.
It's nice to feel bold and go for that one shot. And I've done it before in the past too, where you're like, it's got to be a oneer. And the director's like, it's got to be a oneer. And you do it and then you go and cut it. And it's like,
jump cuts.
Something maybe we can get through this a little quicker, but it's tough to make that decision to be bold and just go for it.
But this was like super freeing for me. And we did do some where I don't think we did give the editor many options, but it was so fun. I feel so like revived and inspired again, actually, by doing this micro budget, because it's kind of a movie that I've always wanted to make but never had the chance.
What's that?
Just the style, like, just like being really loose with it. It's very minimally lit but also harshly lit, kind of embracing like the ugliness of some things. I have in the past few years been trying to master like how to light things so softly. And this was like throwing up a light and then the key grip being like, do you want to put something in front of it? And me being like, no, but really? Straight up that light.
Really?
Yeah. And usually it was still like, we were trying to work with other textures and like curtains and things and giving the feeling of like, it's a crazy hot summer outside that's like harsh, but when you're inside, it's dark. Even though the windows and everything outside is like hard, bright sunlight, inside these houses and locations are like dark and grim a little bit. So that was super fun.
To get that dark tone, would you let things in the background be hot? Like, as far as like if you saw a window, you just let it go? And
yeah. Which is like in the past I never would do. I was always just like, everything has to be balanced. We have to see everything outside every window. And this was like, it's white. It's blown out. I think also like that LUT, talking about the LUTs, whatever that LUT is doing that I developed with Andrew, like, it really softens the highlights in a way that I don't mind them blown out. And that's an Alexa thing too. Like, I wouldn't feel confident about that on other cameras.
And to keep your interiors dimmer, are you actually letting it be underexposed, or are you shooting a healthy neg and then bringing it down later?
Some of it was underexposed for sure. And I would try to make that call about balancing it out a little bit based on the scene too. Like, again, when I was saying like trying to make it a little noisier, can I let this be underexposed to bring in the noise, or does it have to be noise that's introduced still in like a clean neg, properly exposed space? I was like kind of just like free and wild with this movie, which is really fun. Like, not a lot of rules, kind of embracing that. Things overexposed, underexposed, which is, again, relying very heavily on an Alexa and the information that it has the ability to capture.
Did you rate it at a different ISO than the base 800?
Yeah, we rated it at 1600.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pushing it.
Yeah. And usually for nights, I would try to dial it back a little bit. So I'd go to 12 or 8 if I could.
Yeah, you could feel it.
Yeah. And because it was like very minimally lighting nights too. And this was all non-union actors. So I wasn't lighting on a shot-by-shot basis. And it wasn't shot-by-shot. It was often each shot would run the whole scene. And the camera would just follow them and move with them. So it was really minimally lit and lighting spaces and not shots.
This one you shot with super speeds as well?
Yeah.
And do you quite often pull your own focus or do you always have a focus puller?
No, I had a focus puller for this. I mean, I do on doc stuff pull my own focus, not on this. And it was funny because actually one day we were having a real hard time with the remote follow focus and I pulled it off and was like, I'm just going to pull my own focus. But those super speeds are so stiff and going from one side to the other is like, you can't really do it with your hand on the barrel. But I had Mariana Margaret, who's an amazing first AC, and she was great. And it was like unspoken communication all the time. And because again, like this movie was a pretty free feeling, we'd be like, make it more abstract. And she was like, so you want me to do my job worse is what you're asking right now? And I was like, yep. You got it. Let it be soft. But it was fun. It was like really a great feeling to do that stuff and to play with it a little bit more.
Yeah, it's a challenge with the trust that you have for your first AC. Mm-hmm. It takes a little while to find a rhythm with some people mm-hmm. where I pull my own focus on a lot of my own stuff. But recently I've had where when you start out with someone, sometimes you're like, yeah, you know, let it be dreamy. Let it come in and out. I want to feel the focus drifting here and there. And then they'll do that stuff, but they won't hit it the way that you would.
Yeah.
It's like, I see what you're doing, but it's like, no, you need to listen to what's happening.
Yeah.
And watch what's happening and pull the focus there. Just hold the focus and you can actually move your body, the camera position to let the focus drift in and out and just tell them not to do anything.
Like, yeah. Yeah. I found she was so amazing at doing that. It was a dream for me. From take to take, what the camera was doing would change. Like I wasn't doing the same thing each time. So one time I would be on one character and swing to a different character. And then the next take I would stay on one character. And then at the end swing to somebody else, like totally change it up all the time. And she never like blinked an eye. I was just like, yep, let's do it.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good when you find someone like that that can work at that pace. And it's just like, okay,
yeah,
roll with it.
Yeah, it was a really fun project. I'm really excited to see how it works out.
Can you speak about what this project is or is it all in the wraps right now?
No, it's called Firecrackers. We just wrapped last week, so they'll start editing and we'll see what happens.
Great.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like I learn lessons from every project that I'm on, and I hope that continues like forever, that I feel like I'm still learning or that I feel like I'm still scared, or nervous, or excited about things, and that I don't just feel like I'm phoning something in. On a bigger set or on a long format thing, half of our job is dealing with personalities and like people management. That took a while to learn.
How did you learn how to manage your team to make them want to be there after like a 12-hour day turns into an 18-hour day and they still want to stick around and be part of your team, not going home?
I try to lead with like collaboration. I want people to feel like they're a part of it too, and I want to learn from technicians as well. I don't know how people can get through the day if it was just me being like, do this, exactly this, you know, like it's only valuable when people feel like they're a part of it. But it is a weird thing. It's like you have a director, you have producers, you have your team, you have camera team, lighting, grip team, everybody that you're kind of dealing with. And
you're like the navigator to keep everyone happy.
Yeah, it's the most boring part of the job, but it's actually really super important.
So what's the next thing you have coming up?
So I'm going to Vancouver to do a TV series. It's going to be a really crazy change of gears for me coming off of this feature. Because the feature was me literally holding the camera every day, running around. Like, we did a scene where someone sort of smashed a car, and then they ran. And I ran with them for like 2 blocks. And it's like the craziest, shakiest camera ever. But like, my adrenaline level was so high, and I was just like, I felt like I was a part of the film, the characters, the moment of it. And yeah, so it's going to be a really big change of pace to go to like a real set where I'm sitting and I have two operators. But it'll be nice. I'm actually like really looking forward to the challenge of that, because I find my instinct is in the operating world, where I feel like composition and some of that stuff is so instinctual. So I'm looking forward to the challenge of communicating my instinct to operators, but also to be able to concentrate on lighting. Because when you're opping, it's sometimes really hard to tweak lights and continually improve the lighting. It'll be a different thing for sure.
Well, thanks for making the time.
Thank you.
Catherine Lutz.
That was fun.
All right, cool.